Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here talking to this Newton online conference, and I first want to do a sound check and make sure you're hearing my voice all right, so if people can indicate that you hear it okay, just give me a thumbs up. Okay, excellent. What I've decided to do, I didn't really decide what to do until about an hour and a half ago. That's fairly typical for me. I'm sorry about that. Is to talk about the directions in which social computing and especially Web 2.0 type computing is leading e-learning into the future. And so I'm working on a paper which I'll be publishing with the with BECTA, which is a British agency, and so I'll be drawing from that paper as I go along. So it'll look a bit like a presentation. I've got slides, which you can see, and because I don't want any peeking ahead, I haven't given them titles. I'm just kidding you. You can peek ahead all you want. So what I'll do is I'll work through those slides and through that paper and cover the different subjects. And I wish you could see me because I'm gesturing with my hands. I always do that when I'm online, whether or not I have video. But what I'll do also is I'll leave space in between the talking that I do. I do want to encourage you to ask questions and to make comments. So if you see the speaking thing come open, you should certainly feel free to jump in. I'm not sure what you'll see when I pause, but I do want you to feel free to interrupt me and to add your own insights and your own comments to this. Okay, that was one such pause. And I'll give you about 5 or 10 seconds. I'm not going to give you a whole long period of silence, so you're going to have to be a bit quick and jump in there, or you know, signal to Anne-Marie and have her frantically wave her hands or jump in when I give a pause. So when I think of social computing in e-learning, I think of Web 2.0. And when I think of Web 2.0, particularly these days, and in the developments that have taken place through 2005 and throughout 2006, I think about educational technology community-centered, not around instructional design and not around the learning management system, but rather on approaches that dramatically shift the center of e-learning. Things like social networking applications such as ELGG, things like informal learning and e-portfolios, and most of all, things like the personal learning environment, or the PLE. And these things are in turn centered around and draw on a concept in the world of online computing called Web 2.0. Now, the use of Web 2.0 technologies in education has come to be called e-learning 2.0, and I say that because it's my term. And like Stephen O'Hare writes, like the web itself, the early promise of e-learning, that of empowerment, has not been fully realized. But the experience of e-learning has been, for many, no more than a handout published online coupled with a simple multiple-choice quiz, hardly inspiring, let alone empowering. But by using these new web services, e-learning has the potential to become far more personal, social, and flexible. These technologies, in other words, empower students in a way that previous technologies did not. As O'Hare writes, the traditional approach to e-learning tends to be structured around courses, timetables, and testing. That is an approach that is too often driven by the needs of the institution rather than the individual learner. In contrast, e-learning 2.0 takes a small pieces loosely joined approach, and you may recognize that from the book by David Weinberger, an approach that combines the use of discrete but complementary tools and web services, such as blogs, wikis, and other social software, to support the creation of ad hoc learning communities. through 2005 and 2006, in thinking about e-learning 2.0, the concept of the personal learning environment began slowly to take form in the educational technology community. And in fact, I attended some meetings discussing this when I was in Britain through the summer, coalescing around a future VLE diagram authored by CETUS' Scott Wilson. As described by Colin Milligan, PLEs would give the learner greater control over the learning experience, managing their resources, the work they have produced, the activities they participate in, and would constitute their own personal learning environment, which they could use to interact with institutional systems, like to access content, assessment, libraries, and the like. Now, if you take a look at the diagram that's on the screen in front of you, you can see how the future VLE, or the personal learning environment, is structured. It's not a single application. Rather, it's a collection of applications, things like LiveJournal, 43 Things, Flickr, and any of these social networking applications, all connected using various protocols like Atom, RSS, FOAF, and some others, all connected together so that content moves almost seamlessly back and forth between them. And so the future VLE, or the personal learning environment, as it's now being called, would be the individual student's portal to these services offered from a wide variety of content providers across the internet. The idea behind the personal learning environment is that the management of learning migrates from the institution to the learner. The PLE connects to a number of remote services, some that specialize in learning and some that do not. Access to learning becomes access to the resources and the services offered by these remote services. The PLE allows the learner not only to consume learning resources, but to produce them as well. Learning, therefore, evolves from being a transfer of content and knowledge to the production of content and knowledge. Absolutely. Please go ahead, Patricia. Well, Patricia, you've gotten to the core of the problem right away. How do you address the issue of logins? There's a part of the talk later on, in fact, it's almost near the end, where I'll talk a little bit about something called OpenID. The idea here is that we need to have something like a distributed login, which consists of a way for a person, in our case a student, but this would be web-wide, to declare their own identity, and then to have, as part of their browser, a way to, as they go from site to site, declare that identity. And it's a much more open and loosely structured system than some of the federated ID approaches that are being adopted in the university community today, things like Shibboleth and the like. The federated systems work only within the university environment, but as we can see already, we are going to need to go beyond the university environment to make this sort of thing work. I hope that answers your question. If not, you can follow up. Yes and no. The specifications exist. There is software, packages, plugin type packages that have been written in a variety of computer languages. Some sites, such as TechNorati and LiveJournal, have adopted it, but it has not been widely adopted yet. It's still in the process of being adopted, so it's very early days for it. Okay, I'm gonna continue along. And again, as before, that worked very well. I was very pleased with that. So as before, I'll be pausing every so often with the 5 or 10 second intervals for you. So I do encourage you to contribute just like that. As Mark Van Harmelen writes, PLEs are motivated by the need for a standard interface to different institutions' e-learning systems, as well as pedagogic approaches that require that e-learning systems be under the control of the learners themselves. Such a system is needed, additionally, he writes, to support mobile learning or offline learning in a wireless-free hospital, for example, or on a remote mountainside. The PLE is a recognition that the one-size-fits-all approach characteristic of the learning management system will not be sufficient to meet the varied needs of students. It is indeed not even an application per se, the PLE that is, but it's rather a characterization of an approach to learning. As Graham Atwell writes, the PLE is not a software application as such, but rather a mashup of different applications and services. Although, of course, it is possible to develop applications such as ELGG, which bring together much of this functionality and allow ease of access to different services. As such, the key to understanding the PLE lies not in understanding a particular type of technology, so much as it lies in understanding the thinking that underlies the concept, and in turn, the responses to that thinking as found in Web 2.0 and, as Atwell notes, the changing ways in which people are using technologies to communicate and to learn, and the accompanying social effect of such use. The PLE then consists, in effect, of a set of related concepts, each associated with the technologies and applications of Web 2.0, and each describing a shift in emphasis away from what we would characterize learning using the traditional LMS. That was an extra long pause for a bit of coffee. A frequently mentioned from Wenger forward is the occurrence of learning in what have come to be called communities of practice. According to Wenger, communities of practice are groups of people who share a concern or a passion for something they do and learn how to do it better as they interact regularly. In essence, on this theory, to learn is to immerse oneself in a network. And I've had some discussions recently about just exactly how this is structured, whether it's a group like a team or a family, or whether it's something more loosely structured, which I've been styling as a network. And on this theory, it's to immerse oneself in that network, to expose oneself to actual instances of the discipline being performed, where the practitioners of that discipline are, hopefully with some awareness, modeling good practice in the discipline. Or as Thomas Kuhn would say, knowing how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. The student then, through a process of interaction with the practitioners, will begin to practice by replicating what is modeled with a process of reflection, or as the computer geek would say, back propagation, to provide guidance and correction. Learning, in other words, occurs in communities, where the practice of learning is the participation in the community. A learning activity is, in essence, a conversation. And here we come back to David Weinberger again, and we think about things like the Kluge-Train Manifesto, where Weinberger and others say markets are conversations. This conversation in the Web 2.0 era consists not only of words, but of videos, images, multimedia, and more. This conversation forms a rich tapestry of resources, dynamic and interconnected, created not only by experts, but by all members of the community, including learners. Hence, in the first instance, the tools that characterize Web 2.0 are communications tools. Communication tools support direct interaction between individuals. They provide an individual with a means of communicating with one or more members of a network, and hence support social networking. Members typically have a unique identity in such systems and communicate with a collection of other people organized either by membership in a group or forum or belonging to a list of friends or buddies created by the individual. Instant messaging has been touted as the predominant form of communication among younger net users. Email, they say, is only for old people, which kind of makes me feel bad as I look at my 1,000 emails. Each of the major instant messaging tools, ICQ, AIM, Yahoo Messaging, and MSN, allow a user to create a list of contacts known as friends or buddies. And a similar functionality, SMS, operates on mobile phones. Instant messaging is an advance over email because it promotes diversity and decentralization. Each person's list of contacts is unique. Conversations are typically person-to-person, and hence these are called peer-to-peer, P2P, networks. Although in some cases, multi-party conferences are created. P2P file-sharing networks, such as Nutella or Kazaa, work along similar principles, though the creation and maintenance of the contact list is handled automatically by the software. Instant messaging and conferencing tools have expanded from text into audio and video. Skype, for example, is an application that allows free online audio conversations. Each Skype user has a unique identity, and Skype users maintain a contact list of other Skype users. Video conferencing, meanwhile, is already supported by several of the commercial instant messaging products, such as AIM, as well as by Skype. Probably the greatest misapplication. Try that again. Probably the greatest misapplication of online community in online learning lies in the idea that the community is an adjunct to or follows from an online course. And we see this clearly exemplified by the existence in itself of online class discussions. It is common to see the discussion community created with the first class and disbanded with the last. The community owes its existence to the course and ends when the course does. We see this in the evolution of community on the web as well, where early online communities followed a model proffered by Hegel and Armstrong, where the community was centered around a certain website and was run by a certain set of organizers who would take care of the community and in turn monetize that activity. In both cases, the depiction is of a community as a group centered around some location or some activity. Community on the web has evolved differently, however. While people did from time to time cluster around a certain website or service, and we can see that a lot in places like Yahoo, they don't confine their communications to a single mode or a single channel. An online community consists of a much looser set of associations, what the social network theorists such as Mark Gravenetter would call weak ties. A community in this sense could best be described as a cluster of common associations, where these associations are represented as the members in buddy lists, connections in peer-to-peer networks, and other sorts of contact lists. Weak ties are necessary in order to allow the spread of knowledge, and in order for weak ties to be created, there must be several distinct ways or contexts in which people may form them. So in other words, we cannot allow ourselves to focus on one particular application, one particular place, one particular group. We need multiple ways of forming associations. So learning occurs in communities, but communities are not necessarily based on the group, but rather on the network as a whole, where connections cut across existing boundaries via weak ties to form layers of association. The implication is that the course content, if any, ought to be subservient to the discussion, that the community is the primary unit of learning, and that the instruction and the learning resources are secondary, arising out of and only because of the community. And in the Web 2.0 world, it was only a matter of time before they were created by the community. Even LMS... Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, it challenges the way educational institutions and people who work in such institutions, like teachers and professors, look at learning. But I don't think it's a challenge to the way people in the community as a whole look at learning. If you listen to people like Jay Cross and others, and Jay has, you know, Jay comes up with stats and studies from time to time to prove this, 80% of the learning that we do is what's called informal learning. In other words, outside of the educational institution, outside of the course in the classroom. And learning in that sort of context is much more as I've just described. And that's why we see, when we look at these social networks, these Web 2.0 networks with their weak connections and all of that, we see a lot of them supporting learning, a lot of them where learning is actually taking place. So the challenge is for the institution much more so than the learner, I would say. Okay, I take it, Anne-Marie, that the check mark indicates that you're okay with that answer. It's interesting. Every time I go into a group or do something like this, even if it's an online group, every group has their own conventions or their ways of expressing themselves that are very often unique to the group. It's interesting to pick up on them as the time goes through with the session. And the interesting thing, too, is because, people characterize you know, this shift in emphasis from the professor to the learner as something where, okay, well, now the professor is just going to have to go fade into the background, shut off, the learner's in control, all of that, blah, blah, blah. And so there's no role for anybody who has any sort of knowledge or an expertise in what horrible chaos that will bring. But that's not the case. I mean, part of the thing that I want to emphasize when I talk about this whole social networking thing is that these are tools that professors and instructors use as well. And it means not a diminution of the voice of the expert or of the professor or of the instructor, but if anything, an enhancement of that voice. The work that I do on my website is, I think, an example of this sort of practice in action, where I'm not leading classes, I'm not stepping people through courses or anything like that, but by working publicly, by creating and sharing what I do, I am providing input to this community of practice, and input which may or may not be deemed by members of the community to be authoritative or worth following or anything like that. But I very much have a voice, and I very much am involved in a process of describing, explaining, modeling, sometimes even arguing and etc. But it's a distributive kind of model where I don't assume and I don't look for some sort of power or control or mechanism of coercion over the students. It's up to them whether to follow me, but that does not mean that I, as a person who's a leader, simply shuts up and lets them lead the way. I still have my views and I still contribute to this community, as I should. So even the LMS-based learning recognizes that learning is best accomplished through some sort of activity rather than some rote online content consumption or memorization. And that said, though, the history of online learning is remarkable for its emphasis on content consumption, as evidenced by the activity surrounding course creation and learning object design. But as George Seaman writes, as learners move beyond content consumption and into stages of critical thinking, collaboration, and content creation, LMS weaknesses become apparent. Content creation tools enable the creation of content. And what distinguishes the current set of content creation tools is that the content creation occurs or is largely supported online, and hence converts the act of creating content into a social and connected act. Learning management systems, insofar as they support content, go ahead, Judy. Oh, okay. Okay, I'm not hearing any voices, but I am pausing because I do see some hands up. Okay, well, that's a great question. And there's two sides of the answer to that, I would say. And certainly in my own approach, there are two sides. On one side, from the perspective of the individual learner, things like critical thinking and the other skills needed in order to evaluate content become much more important, because they're not going to necessarily be able to rely on an authority to tell them what is good content and what is bad content. And I think that's a good thing, because the track record of authorities in distinguishing these two hasn't been good through history. So I've done things like put up a site which is a guide to the logical fallacies, and I've put up a paper on how to evaluate websites. And it's just the basic skills that people need in order to be able to determine for themselves whether something is trustworthy or not trustworthy. So that's the one side of it. The second side of it is that this evaluation becomes a network phenomenon. What that means is that all of the people who are online, who are looking at these resources, are making their determination of whether this is a good resource or a bad resource. So the process is something gets published, it gets distributed online, people start reading it, and then as they read it, they react to it. And there's any number of ways that they can react to it. They might simply enter a thumbs up or a thumbs down opinion. They might rate it on a 1 to 5 scale. They might even write reviews like people do on Amazon.com or the Internet Movie Database. The combination of these reactions constitutes what's known as a recommender system. And it's kind of interesting, because in my previous engagement with Newton at the I think it was the annual conference that was held in Maine at Kennebunkport a year or two ago, I outlined all the details of this recommender system that is used for evaluation. And so what happens is that the user who is able to access a recommender system is able to get from that system a statement of the form, people that are like you liked resources that are like such and such. And so there does become, through the process of the whole network evaluating things, the possibility of the sum total of those evaluations being presented back to you. But interestingly, presented back to you in a very personal way. And this captures the idea not simply of whether resources are good or bad, but it captures the concept of resources being good for you or bad for you. Because when you think about it, something that is good might not be good for everybody. James Joyce is good, but I wouldn't inflict James Joyce on a grade 3 student. Just wouldn't do it. Well, it's interesting, I'd want to draw out the concept of what you mean by a hub to bring them all together. I mean, from the perspective of an individual, such as myself or yourself, we're not going to go poking one by one through 10 billion different resources hoping we find just the thing that we need. I mean, that's not going to happen. But it doesn't follow from that that the best way of organizing resources online is to create some sort of centralized hub or repository. Now, we do have, things like Google and we have some smaller sites like Amazon or Internet Movie Database or Yahoo or whatever that do work as hubs. But now these are trying to act as hubs for everybody. And when you try to act as a hub for everybody, you're sort of good, but not really what anybody in particular wanted. So what's going to have to happen is, instead of having big hubs that serve everybody, we need what might be called personalized or individual hubs, right? And that's what the personal learning environment is intended to accomplish. The personal learning environment by interacting with these various systems is intended to be your way of reaching out into all of the resources that are out there, and through your network of connections with buddies and other associates. I hate the term buddies, but that's what they use. I don't know why. But through your social network, to aggregate or bring together these resources and organize them in such a way and present them in such a way that they're useful to you. So I would say the personal learning environment is your personal hub. That's how I would answer that question. I think over time, I think things are going to change pretty dramatically. And I think that the role of the instructor is actually going to devolve into a number of very distinct functions, which will not necessarily all be undertaken by one person. Because, I mean, if you look at the instructor, even right now, I can identify, just off the top of my head, identify three major roles. One major role is of content producer and distributor, the person who has the knowledge and gives it to you. Another role is of mentor and coach, the person who's there, who encourages you, gives you help when you need it. And then another role is of role model, a person who's an exemplar. This person is not simply a teacher of physics, but this person is also a researcher of physics. I think these roles are going to split apart. I've always said this. I said this as far back as 98 in my paper, The Future of Online Learning, and I still believe that this is true. I think that what we see as instruction is going to change shape dramatically. The content creation and delivery part, which everybody seems to focus on as instruction, properly so-called, I see being less and less the role of an instructor. That doesn't convert them into guides by the side or whatever, but it becomes more the role of the community and the technology supporting that community to create and distribute content. And that was the next part of this paper, which we won't get into in a whole lot of detail because we're practically out of time. But the idea here is that members of the community can create the content. The content goes into the system and then is looked at and distributed by all the members of the community. And that is just the practice of performing that task. There will be a role, a very large role, and very much an in-person role. People don't understand this yet, for coaches and mentors and things like that. And it's the second part of the triad, right? The triad is the instructor, the content deliverer. The other part of the triad is the student, and then the third part of the triad is this coach or the mentor. And this is a role we've never really had before, but I think that will become more and more important. The idea of the learning professional who is not there to evaluate the student and rate them or anything like that, but the person who's there, who's on the student's side, who's an advocate for the student, who helps them navigate this great jungle that we call the internet or that we call the profession of physics or whatever. And then the third part of this is, again, I said, the model, the role model or the exemplar. I commented on Will Richardson's blog the other day. Will Richardson was saying, well, blogging creates a world where there's a billion teachers. And let's look at blogging. And I commented something like, well, let's imagine a world of a billion teachers. Because the capacity to create content and to make this content freely available actually does make, in a certain sense, everybody a type of teacher. If we perform our profession in an open manner, then in the act of performing the profession, we are also becoming a teacher. I'll give you a simple little example of this. Those of you who've flown around the United States may be familiar with something on airplanes called Channel 9. I think it's Channel 9. Yeah, it's Channel 9. We don't have it in Canada yet, which really bugs me. And what Channel 9 is, you just, you know, you put on your headset and you plug into the airplane's radio system, and you tune to Channel 9, and what you're hearing is all the pilots' communications with the control tower, and you're hearing the control tower speak back, and you're hearing other airplanes and all of that. And so you're sitting there listening to all the chatter that's happening, you know, to control air traffic. And it's just incredibly fascinating. Well, you have to be interested in planes and stuff like that to find it fascinating, but I find it incredibly fascinating. And this is what I mean by doing your work openly. If somebody is very interested in airplanes, follows this, listens to this, this becomes a part of their learning environment. And now all of the people involved in the process, the pilots, the air traffic controllers, and all of the like, they're doing their job, but they're also being teachers. And so we take these three things together, the content creation, the coaching and the mentoring, and then the role modeling, and these are all now embodied in one person. But there won't be a need, and there are actually good reasons why we shouldn't continue to embody them in one person. We'll see more and more that these things get devolved into separate functions. That's my view, anyways. Okay, Anne-Marie, I'm reading 2:56 p.m., which means it's 1:56 p.m. Your time right now. How much time do you want to continue, and how would you like to proceed from here, please? All right, well, that sounds good. I'm going to jump over some of the content creation stuff because I've already talked about it a little bit, so the Google Groups and the blogging engines, and also, too, I think probably people are familiar with Blogger and MySpace and so on. And I want to try to draw on what I just finished talking about a little bit about those devolving roles, because what happens in Web 2.0 is that, how do I want to phrase this? I'm segueing across about like three pages of stuff here. Where learning moves out of the classroom and into the environment in which learning is to take place. And I mentioned earlier on, in this talk, Jay Cross and the distinction between formal and informal learning, and that's what's happening here. Sorry, I just thought I'd wait out my clock, which was chiming in the background. When learning becomes the creation of content, the community of practice, then learning becomes something that is characterized not by instruction in the classroom, but rather by dialogue and communication within a given context. And Jay Cross is talking about a similar thing when he talks about informal learning. In a similar manner, learners interacting with each other through a learning environment will access help not only with the software, but also with the subject matter with which they are dealing. Learning will be available not in learning institutions, or not only in learning institutions, I ought to say, but in any given environment, in which learners find themselves. Now, what needs to be understood, and what becomes a real challenge here, is that learning environments are multidisciplinary. That is to say, the environments are not constructed in order to teach geometry or to teach philosophy. The learning environment rather becomes an emulation of some real-world application or discipline. Managing a city, for example. Building a house. Flying an airplane. Setting a budget. Solving a crime. And it's interesting, all of those things that I just gave you examples of have their counterpart in real-world games or applications. And in the process of undertaking any of these activities, learning from a large number of disciplines is required. Indeed, as in the case of the electronic performance support system, these environments may actually be some real-world application. These environments cut across disciplines. Students will not study algebra beginning with the first principles and progressing through the functions. They'll learn the principles of algebra as needed, progressing more deeply into the subject as the need for new knowledge is provoked by the demands of the simulation, or the activity, or the project. I like to tell the story of how I learned trigonometry. I took it three times, once in high school, once in college, once in university, but I actually learned it when I needed to rotate cubes for a Star Trek game I was building in my free time. Learning opportunities, either in the form of interaction with others or in the form of online learning resources, what were formerly known as learning objects, or in the form of interaction with mentors or instructors, will be embedded in the learning environment, sometimes presenting themselves spontaneously, sometimes presenting themselves on request. Now, this idea of context-sensitive learning is not new. It's already supported to a large degree in existing software. Microsoft's Help system, for example, if it only helped, would be an example of such a system. In a similar manner, learners interacting with each other through a learning environment will access help not only with the software, but also with the subject matter they're dealing with. Learning will be available not in learning institutions, but wherever they happen to find themselves. And that's how we should be looking at the personal learning environment. It's tempted to think of the personal learning environment as a content management device or as a file manager. And even our RSS readers that we see today, which are used to access blogs and other such content, look like file managers. But the heart of the personal learning environment is that it's a tool, or more accurately, a set of specifications that allows a learner or anyone to engage in a distributed environment consisting of a network of people, services, and resources. It's not just Web 2.0, but it's Web 2.0 in the sense, in the broadest sense, that it's a read-write environment. The development of blogs and other content creation tools was concurrent with the development of the system for the organization and the distribution of that content. In other words, the mechanics, the background that we use in order to make all of this content stuff work. And most of this work is centered around the content syndication format developed by Netscape called RSS, or Rich Site Summary, or as people have started calling it these days, Real Simple Syndication, or Really Simple Syndication, or sometimes RDF Site Summary, or sometimes ATOM. And this format, the specification, was originally designed to list indices of newspaper and magazine articles, but it worked especially well for personal publishing and really, really well for blogs. Now, I think that we're in the very early days of content syndication. Now, we've seen some of the uses of it so far. We've seen content aggregators like BlogDex or Daypop or PopDex, or as I've got on the screen here, Google Reader. And we've seen listings of top 10 blogs or, you know, the top 100 stories of the day and all of that. And we've seen even some simple management of these resources according to category. with the concept of tagging or user user indexing of contents. And we've seen these merged or mixed with social networking applications. But all of this still, at this point, exists pretty much in its own world. It's all still pretty much online. It's all still pretty much about the organization of resources. But what we are going to see over time more and more is the use of systems like this, RSS, the identity system that I talked about in the earlier on, and this network of content produced by this network of people. This will create, if you will, a learning infrastructure or a content infrastructure, sort of like a resource that can be embedded into other devices, other things that we use. If you think, a good example will be electricity. Electricity is a type of infrastructure. We have ways of producing it, and these ways of producing it might be, you know, hydroelectric plants or coal plants or whatever, and then the electricity is plugged into a network, or as we call it, the grid. And then we have, in whatever environment we're in, we have electricity available to us, and we can insert that electricity right into our devices, into things like toasters, for example, or computers or televisions. And so the electricity helps power these applications. And in the same way, learning, information, these sorts of resources will be piped right into our applications, and again, we'll power them, but we'll power them as learning devices and not merely functional devices. Another metaphor, another way of thinking about this is language itself. If you think about it, written language used to be something that you had to go to see. You know, you had to visit a monastery or maybe a library or something like that. But as time passed and language became more mobile and more accessible, we find that we can use language to do all kinds of things right in the place that we need it. If you go to your kitchen and you pull a box of Kraft Dinner off the shelf, what you will find is on the side of that box instruction in how to make the Kraft Dinner. And what we've done is we've put a little bit of language right on the side of that box, which is an amazing thing when you think about it. And so you have a language reader, which is your mind, and there's the language insertion device, which is the printing press that put the writing on the box. And so we have a way of inserting some learning on this box. And learning in the future will work very much the same way. We're moving toward that, except instead of having some static predefined text on your Kraft Dinner box, you'll have basically an opening, a portal, a way in to see this whole network of Kraft Dinner related content as it relates to you, as it is evaluated through the recommender system by the community. What this does, and I'm just wrapping up now, is it creates an environment where the support of learning really is the development and deployment of these network tools. And in looking at how such a network best supports learning, my own view is that tools and applications that support four fundamental properties are those that will support learning in the way that I've just described. And you can see them there on the screen. Tools that promote diversity, in other words, the use of different applications, the use of different tools, the use of different computer languages. Tools that support autonomy, the capacity to make one's own decisions, navigate in one's own way, choose their own priorities. Tools that support connectedness, the capacity to create and send that creation to another person, the capacity to interact, to take part in this conversation that I've been talking about. And then tools that support openness, the idea here that people can connect not just to their classroom or not just to their institution, but can connect to anybody, so that the fundamental, the default position of the system is anybody can connect to anybody. These four principles form what I call the semantic condition. And in a network where the semantic condition is satisfied, the network will become what I call a learning network. In other words, it will become an environment where people interacting with other people can learn in the way that I've described. And that's overall what I wanted to say about social software and Web 2.0 and learning, and I certainly hope you found it interesting. Ha, ha, ha.